Good evening. I'm just back from California late last night from a retreat with teachers of the Pacific Zen Institute and a visit with our founding teacher, Joan Sutherland, who sends her love. And tonight I'd like to spend time with this koan that I introduced during the meditation. And we're beginning there by way of introducing a topic I'd like to investigate with you over the next bit of time. And I guess I could say the topic broadly seen is, what is it like to be part of a collaborative, creative adventure we call the koan way? What are the characteristics of it, and what might it offer you? What might it offer me, and what might I offer, bring to it? But I'm hoping that the individual pieces of this conversation will be of value to you, will be helpful. So as a starting point for tonight, let me say one more time the koan that I brought into the meditation. This one is just the second koan in the Blue Cliff record. The first one is the one where Bodhidharma meets the Emperor Wu, and who asks, what is the most sacred teaching of Buddhism? And Bodhidharma says, vast emptiness, nothing sacred. And the emperor says, who is this standing in front of me? And Bodhidharma says, I don't know. So the first koan of this whole sort of central collection of body of koans that have been transmitted to us has this meaty mystery of I don't know built into it. And the second one then goes like this, with the old teacher Jiaozhou saying, the great way isn't difficult, it just doesn't pick and choose. When you hear me say this, you might think, well, that's picking and choosing. Or you might think, that's clear. But I don't identify with clarity. Can you live this way? And the person asks, well, if you don't identify with clarity, what do you live by? You know, isn't clarity what we live by? And Jiaozhou says, I don't know. So we have I don't know on top of I don't know here, don't we? And then later someone asks, actually asks a different teacher, but it's part of the same conversation, what is the way? What is it? What is this way? Dragon murmurings in a dead tree. What's that? I have joy. And there's still later another piece of the conversation, as there often is in this koan way. Someone asked Tsao-chan, a different guy, who can hear these dragon murmurings? And Tsao-chan answered, there's no one in the world who isn't hearing it. So we're not talking about something rare and rarefied and inaccessible, yeah? We're talking about what you have, the only thing you have, moment by moment by moment. We want clarity, don't we? We crave it. And we crave it more and more the more things are uncertain and hard to see. So I think we flee towards it. I notice myself fleeing towards it when we have anxiety, when I have anxiety. And you know, how many times lately, ever since Obama, have you heard politicians saying, let me be perfectly clear, or let's be clear about this, right? And I think that's kind of a little hook out there, right? I'm going to give you some clarity here. And I'm curious about, how does that actually make you feel? Probably not all one way, yeah? But it's kind of a, might be an interesting thing to notice. When you come across that, let's be very clear here. Let me be clear. Then what does that bring up for you? And then on the other hand, when someone presents something and won't bring it to clarity, gives you the unclarity of it, how's that? And then, if you will, think about times when you have experienced your most intimate delight. Was there something about clarity there? I queried myself this way. And in my experience, those moments had nothing to do with clarity. They had no need for clarity. It wasn't really the issue, yeah? And in fact, in those moments, I think I would have seen it as the booby prize, right? As not alive, not having any juice left in it, if it was about clarity. Not to mention maybe a lie, you know, not true to the moment. Because being in the presence of the mystery, of this mystery, any moment, right now, is the experience. So there's a lovely bit from Shwedo's. The compiler of the Blue Cliff Record wrote verses. Here's some bits from that. Where the land meets the sky, the sun rises, the moon sets. Beyond the railing, the mountains are deep, the water's cold. When the thoughts in your skull are used up, why does joy remain? When the thoughts in your skull are used up, why does joy remain? Dragon murmurings in the dried up tree aren't used up. Is it really that difficult? Picking and choosing, clarity, see for yourself. What seems to happen in our lifelong process of awakening is not, in my experience, is not that everything becomes clearer. I don't know if anything's become clearer. It's just that everything becomes more intimately here, just as it is. More vivid, more, more. And there's a sense of nothing being extra, nothing being missing that comes with that. And many, many, if not all, of the koans are hinting at this. So we have koans like, what is it practice must mend? Right? What is it you're trying to fix with your practice? But I think it's really helpful to learn to notice the ways that we flee the intimacy that has uncertainty built into it, and what it's like when we don't. And we could have that as our whole practice, you know, day in and day out, moment in, moment out, in meditation, out of meditation, to notice that impulse to flee towards clarity when there's uncertainty. And what it's like, and to notice the moments when there's no fleeing, there's no place to go, there's no need to go there, yeah? Nothing that needs to be fixed, nothing that needs to be pinned into a clear view. Those moments. So within the traditions of Buddhism, under the kinds of duress that come up culturally again and again from then until now, I think right within our traditions there are manifestations of this very human desire to flee the discomfort of uncertainty. And so mindfulness is many things to many people, and the practices of mindfulness offer tools for settling into awareness of what is. And the very popularity of the term mindfulness and of the sort of varieties of spread of mindfulness make me somewhat suspicious, because if what we're facing worldwide is a kind of a flood of anxiety, and we're looking for tools to manage our anxiety, we're likely to run towards certainty. And so we can bend a practice like mindfulness to that purpose, and then I think it gets small and box-like and not that helpful in the long run. That sounds a little abstract, but I don't know if you know what I mean. So, for example, someone came to us once saying with a great deal of emotion that mindfulness practice had saved his life. And I don't doubt that. I had no argument with that at all. That's a beautiful thing to have had happen, and a beautiful thing to have discovered. But as he sat into a slightly different perspective and was presented with not answers but questions, this person got really, really uncomfortable. And so there was a kind of brittleness that showed up in that sense of this saved my life, so this is the way, and this is how I do it, and don't tell me anything otherwise. Yeah, that's what I mean about that fleeing to certainty. It's kind of sometimes sort of shows up as like, I'll just chop carrots, right? You know, when I'm just chopping carrots, I know what I'm doing. And don't interrupt that. it can sort of show up that way. Those pesky other things that come up, I'll just let them go, which kind of sometimes means a code for I will make them go. Yeah. I'll be so aware of what's going on in my body, I won't have to think about that homeless person on the corner. Yeah, I'm going to be mindfully walking, and it becomes. Is this making sense? It becomes a kind of closing out rather than an opening to the built-in beautiful uncertainty of your actual experience at the moment. Or sometimes a word, like a word can become a code word, and it can, and I'm not just saying in other people's ways, I mean us, right? Me. And so an example of that I'm aware of is like interbeing. That if I say, we're all just interbeing, that'll cure my anger. You know, if I just remember we're all interbeing, then I won't be angry anymore about, you know, what's happening. And so can you see how that is a kind of fleeing from certainty to certainty rather than building a kind of core of strength in staying present in the uncertainty, in the discomfort, and in the beauty. And so what can happen then if somebody discovers, this is a little too narrow for me, this is to then try to add something else in. So, I just need to add compassion. So now I'll take up the practices of compassion, and that will fix me. That will fix my problem of being too simply fixed on mindfulness. Can you see how that goes? I'm going to find the next thing that will be a remedy, and that's another seeking of clarity. So what else do we do when we're not doing that? It's not a problem to do that. Can you understand I'm saying this is just a human thing that we do? So then how do we hold this with warmth and sympathy for ourselves and each other? Because this habitual thing of trying to make things clear involves shutting out most of what's happening. Because how much of what's actually happening is clear to you? What percent do you think of what is actually happening is clear? And so are we wanting to just pay attention to the part that we can get clarity on? That seems like a little bit small. So which is why I love so much and so often bring in Bodhidharma's comment in our precepts, that at the beginning of each of our precepts, he already gives us a little tweak away from making this precept a rule, making, you know, I vow not to lie, you know, that's going to be my rule, that's going to fix it for me. I'm clear about that, I'm not going to lie. And so the first thing he says is, the way things are is mysterious and hard to see. He's not saying, let me help you see clearly how things are. right? I don't think that's what the offer is. He's saying that each time that we remember that clarity is not the fundamental nature of our experience, each time we come back to noticing how it really is for us in this wild, wild world, we can take refuge in our actual experience, in what we intimately know without the knowing about it, without looking at it, what we already know because we are it. To take refuge in our actual experience and move from there and respond from there. So I think I'd like to mention one more kind of dodge that I think we might be tempted to make at this particular point in history. And that's the one about there's not time, you know, the world urgently needs us right now and we must act and we must engage. And because the apocalypse is coming. And we Buddhists aren't engaging enough with the very real problems of the world, yeah? With abuses, with war, with oppression, with the approaching apocalypse. So let's make a manifesto. Let's make a Buddhist manifesto. Because all the other ones are too, whatever, pick your term, right? Too aggressive, too, and then everybody can pay attention and be mindful and this will be our way. Let's agree on a reality and act on it. So I bring this in because such a manifesto landed on my desk last week, and I started to read it, and it was very powerful, and it was like this person or this group is really wading in here, and I just found myself feeling sick to my stomach and turning away. And I thought, huh, that's interesting. You know, these are my folks, you know, wanting to address the real things that need to be addressed. And so here comes the manifesto. It's like another attempt at clarity. And so one of the things that I really, really love about the koans, about what's offered to us in this long, long tradition, is that that's not the way they go. That's not where they go. They trust our own experience and bring us back to that again and again and again. What's your own experience of this very life that's yours? The one that is yours right now. And they ask the hard questions. So some of the koans, like, stop the sound of that distant temple bell. You know, they pose the impossible questions for us, right up front, right? They don't say you're not supposed to do anything, right? Stop the sound of that distant temple bell. Stop the war is one of our early koans. Put out the fire across the river. Someone's jumping, you know, save the person who's on the 90th floor of the Twin Towers is one of our koans. Taking the form of one yin, find shelter for the homeless. So these are not saying do nothing, are they? But they are not posing the answer, the clarity. They're saying, here we are, here we are. So am I saying we shouldn't be practicing mindfulness? Not at all. Am I saying we shouldn't be trying to save the world? Not at all. But what I am saying is that this koan way engages us in a different process altogether. It's a different project. Over the long arc of a life, the long arc of life on the planet, the koans recognize that the fundamental activity is awakening. That this is what's happening in us. This is what's happening in our world. It is what we're made of. The non-active activity that permeates every moment of a life. Every moment we're discovering, oh, this, and we're having a response. That's the nature of awakening. Oh, this. What? Meeting it. That the way the vastness of each moment is expressed as you, as me, as the floor, without losing any tiny aspect of its vastness, is the fundamental mystery out of which the inexpressible beauty of this sublime universe blooms. That's my experience. That we can relax into the actual nature of this existence we've been given. This very one life that's for you, that's for me. We can relax into it and trust it. And that when we do this, we develop not only the capacity to be in the presence of that which is not clear, at ease with it, but then to come from that no place as each of us a unique expression of it. So when we can truly upright in ourselves, relax into it, just as it is, then we can come forth as the expression of this through us. An expression that mysteriously completes it. Hard to accept that, isn't it? It's a weird thing to accept that my coming forth as the expression of what is right here somehow completes it. But I would invite you to consider, could that be? Just as it is. Can you live this way? Zhao Zhou asks. So that was much more of a rant than I realized it would be, and a little abstract. So I'd be interested in hearing what might have connected for you, if anything. And then I have a couple of bits of poems to offer before we start. Thank you.
Would you have some poems? Did you have some poems to share?
Oh yeah, poems. I do. Let's see. This one. Here's one. That I may have read to you before. If so, I'm doing it again. It's from William Merwin, A Momentary Creed. I believe in the ordinary day that is here at this moment and is me. I do not see it going its own way, but I never saw how it came to me. It extends beyond whatever I may think I know and all that is real to me. It is the present that it bears away. Where is it gone when it has gone from me? There is no place I know outside today except for the unknown all around me. The only presence that appears to stay. Everything that I call mine, it lent me. Even the way that I believe the day, for as long as it is here and is me. So I love the way that puts, I believe in the ordinary day, right up against the unknownness that's in the heart of it. Yeah, it's sort of like that commitment in the presence of I don't know. Yeah. This one is from Czesław Miłosz. Called this. If I could at last tell you what is in me, if I could shout, people, I have lied by pretending it was not there. It was there day and night. I thought that was pretty lovely. And then that does this, I don't know where this one came from, this definition of beauty, a mental solvent that dissolves something else, melting it into radiance. I'll read that one again because that dissolving felt to me like letting go of clarity in favor of beauty. Yeah, beauty. A mental solvent that dissolves something else, melting it into radiance.